And it is with great honor and privilege that I am proud to announce our speaker, Tim M. from Los Angeles.
Thank you, man, sir. My name is Tim Meyer. I'm gratefully powerless over alcohol, sex, love, and other drugs. A fantastically grateful member of Al-Anon, and incredibly grateful to be here sober this morning. It's a Sunday. I don't drink alcohol on Sundays. You know, when you laugh at me, it hurts my delicate snowflake feelings. I joined the U.S. Army and went to chaplain basic training at age 51 with no prior service. So right off the bat, I have to get off my chest the resentment I have against you idiots in rooms like this, who for 27 years at that point had been telling me, Tim, pray only for knowledge of God's will and the power to carry that out. So while I was the undergraduate research coordinator and director of the honors program in the Department of Biological Sciences at Stanford University, I joined the fucking U.S. Army. Now, are we or are we not supposed to be restored to sanity? Anyway, we'll get back to that. Thank you to the committee in my head. I mean, the committee that invited me. I think they're two different entities, but sometimes I wonder. I'm especially grateful, Natalie, to everything you've done to spearhead this, and to Steve R., who has been crucial to getting everything running smoothly, so thank you all. How many of my sobriety siblings in the room today are either military veterans or related to one as a child, a parent, or a spouse? Could I see a show of hands? So this tells me that, like alcoholism, the U.S. military is a family disease. Yeah, who knew? So I'm here because, evidently, Mansoor had so much pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, he wound up talking with me. So on his behalf, I apologize to all of you ahead of time. And many, many years ago, as I was learning how to lead weekend retreats for folks in 12-step recovery programs, the fabulous Father Tom W., once of the People's Republic of Berkeley, told me that the only thing he wanted in return for his mentoring me was for me to make sure that any time I spoke publicly, I would remind the people hearing me that my recovery should serve as a warning to them. Because if I had only followed directions early on, I would be so much better now than I am. So we've completed that. My sobriety date is the 10th of September, 1979, which means that today I complete 2,398 weeks of being sober, which translates into 551 months plus 15 days, which is 16,186 days, something like that, which is 45 years, 11 months, and 15 days. And I only say that because I'm a nerd and I like numbers, even though I hate math, so I don't know how that works. And I especially hate statistics, Steve, so I'm really glad that somebody is able to do statistics because I can't. But I say that because it proves that there's got to be a really humongous higher power. Because only a higher power could have gotten me sober and kept me sober for 45 years, 11 months, and 15 days. And if it can work for me, it can work for you. Because no matter how long you have been sober, you can help when no one else can. It's not, when I got to the program, I heard people telling fabulous stories like I got drunk and I woke up in another country, married to somebody I didn't know, and I thought that's really glamorous drinking. My drinking was dull. I drank, I passed out, I vomited, and I didn't die. And that was, don't bother to rinse, repeat. So my drunkalogue is really dull. That's what it was like. What happened was, a really good friend of mine was sent into forced recovery, and I figured he was just being brutalized because he came from a rich family and blah, blah, blah. And besides, there was no way Stan could be an alcoholic because I drank more than he did. So in September of 1979, I stopped drinking to be in solidarity with Stan. And I actually white-knuckled not drinking for 9 months. During that 9 months, Stan wound up being sent to this fabulous drunk tank for priests in Lake Orion, Michigan. At the time, it was located in the mansion that had been built by the Scripps family of Scripps Howard fame. And they had servants and a golf course. And he had a spiritual awakening. Now, I ask you, who's not going to have a spiritual awakening when you have servants and a golf course? I probably wouldn't have, so that's why they didn't send me in, clearly. Anyway, he got back from there, and all we did was fight. So in June of 1980, he dragged my sorry ass, kicking and screaming, to an Al-Anon meeting. And at that meeting, I experienced a spiritual awakening. That spiritual awakening was, oh my God, the problem in my family is alcoholism. And then the next night, it might have been two nights later, it's sort of a blur, he dragged my sorry ass with him to his home group in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan, at the Cranbrook School, which is very hoity-toity. And there were probably 100 people there at this meeting. And the meeting started, and they said the Serenity Prayer, and then the meeting broke up into tables, which is a peculiarly southeastern Michigan phenomenon. And those tables were AA tables, and Al-Anon tables, and combined AA Al-Anon tables. And when I moved to California early 90s, and I would talk about this, people would clutch their pearls and fall back on their fainting couches. Oh my God, that's against their traditions! And the fact was, well, maybe it was, but it worked, and they're still doing it. And that night, at the combined AA Al-Anon first step table, I realized, holy shit, the problem with Tim is alcohol. And I haven't had to have a drink since then. And I'm really grateful that this program works if we let it. And here's how I believe, well, here's how I've led it. I come to a lot of meetings. I don't drink or use between those meetings. I try to be of service. I sponsor and am sponsored. I read program literature. And several times a day, I talk to at least one other person who's in recovery for whatever ails one. And I've learned that my friend Tom, from whom I steal everything, but at least I tell people that, he used to steal everything from his sponsor, Monsignor Terry, but he would never tell people that he did that. Anyway, that's an outside issue, I suppose. So Tom said to me, Tim, if you're not in at least three 12-step programs, you're still in denial. And I'm really grateful that my first AA sponsor, Gil, was married to my first Al-Anon sponsor, Dorothy. He had his program, she had her program, they had their program. He had gotten sober in the, I think it was 1966. She got into Al-Anon, she helped found Al-Anon in Michigan around 1960, something like that. When she died, she had almost 60 years in Al-Anon. So 5 or 6 years into her being into Al-Anon, Gil finally got sober. And then 2 years into his sobriety, he decided he wanted what she had, and he started going to Al-Anon meetings. Now, here's a news flash. Male alcoholics in Detroit, Michigan did not go to the Ladies of Perpetual Revenge. But Gil did. And a year and a half or 2 years into his being in Al-Anon, he began to require of every alcoholic he sponsored, even brand new sober, that that guy go to at least one Al-Anon meeting a week, in addition to all the AA meetings. And he would say, why am I making you do this? Because Al-Anon gives me the tools to deal with my reaction to an alcoholic's shit. And if I sponsor you in AA, I hate to break it to you, I'm an alcoholic. And I want you to have tools to deal with your reaction to my shit. He died sober in the 90s. He had either, it was just shy of 30 years or maybe 30 years. And the night before the funeral, Dorothy had said, well, I guess we'll have a rosary. And I said, Dorothy, we could always do a rosary. Let's have a meeting. So we had a meeting at the funeral home. And 200 people came to that meeting. It actually lasted almost 2 hours. And every single alcoholic who got up to share at that meeting also identified as a grateful member of Al-Anon because of Gil's power of example. And so many Al-Anon folks who shared at that meeting did so through tears. And each of them said, without fail, Gil Gatchell saved my father, brother, husband, son's life. This is a program that works. And for me, the way it works is I need to claim the powerlessness of right now. Because step one says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. And for those of you who have never darkened the door of Al-Anon, guess what? It's exactly the same first step in Al-Anon as it is in AA. So you're all welcome. And what I've learned, especially from Al-Anon, is that I would use my reaction to other people's shit as my excuse to justify picking up a drink. And I often drank at you. And I learned that if I can name the powerlessness of right now, I've got a program that consists of 11 and a half other steps. And those steps work no matter what the powerlessness du jour might happen to be. And let me tell you, joining the military in my 50s with no prior service opened up worlds of powerlessness which I had never before imagined. And here's another news flash. The U.S. military doesn't even think powerlessness is a thing. I know that's hard to imagine. But, you know, we're the U.S. military. We kick ass, right? We're not powerless over nothing. Which makes it really hard for military veterans to get this program. Powerlessness is completely foreign to the mindset of U.S. warriors. But you know, it ought not to be that much of a surprise. How many of you played team sports? Okay, how often, just before the game, would your coach say to you, "I want you to go out there and surrender"? Doesn't happen, right? Until the second and third editions of the AA Big Book, no, maybe it was just the second edition, had a story that was called The Professor and the Paradox. It was a really wonderful story. And he listed four paradoxes of recovery, one of which was, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we surrender to win. How the hell is that even possible? Surrender to win? Bullshit. Except, look at our experience. I got in a lot of trouble when I was in the military. It started even before I had been to chaplain basic training. I managed to piss off the commanding general of 1st Army East. So I was an O3, that was my rank. I was a captain. And this guy was a major general, which meant he was an 08, five pay grades above me. And I managed to piss him off because I told him truths that he didn't want to hear, and so none of his subordinates would tell him. And at one point, he said to me, "These soldiers are just trying to pull the wool over your eyes." And I looked at him and I said, "Sir, with all due respect, I'm an alcoholic and I've been sober for 27 years. I think I know when somebody's trying to shit me." That didn't go over very well. I also got in a lot of trouble on my second deployment, which was back-to-back with my first deployment. I had four deployments in the military, each time without a weapon. Because as a chaplain, I'm a non-combatant. So, talk about powerlessnesses. Going into a war zone an active war zone without a weapon opened up a whole lot of powerlessnesses for Tim. Anyway, my second deployment happened right on the heels of my first deployment, so much for one weekend a month, 2 weeks in the summer. And I knew that the unit that I was joining up with was a cav unit, cavalry. And when I was in Iraq, I had served with the 1st Infantry Division, who, when they do things, wear big 10-gallon hats, Stetsons. And even though I was not a cav soldier, because I served in this cav unit, I got authorized to wear one of these Stetsons, and they even authorized me combat spurs, which is a really big deal in the cav community. So I knew I was going with a cav unit to Kosovo. Most people in the U.S. don't even know where Kosovo is. Except that this was the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment. And instead of wearing the big black Stetsons, they wear what's called the campaign hat, which is smaller, tan, a much narrower brim. It was worn by Teddy Roosevelt and his Rough Riders in Cuba. And so I decided, well, it's a cav unit. I don't own one of these hats, so I'm going to bring my Stetson with me. The first time we had a commander's update brief in the in-country, that happened the day after I arrived, because I managed a scam whereby I came back to the States and did some training, other training, and then flew back civilian and got there. Anyway, I wear my cav hat. There are probably 24 people in the Joint Operations Center who are wearing their campaign hats. The commander and command sergeant major walk in. They're both wearing campaign hats. Everybody stands up at attention. And instead of saying, as you were, or please be seated, the commander says, one of these is not like the others. Now, I was still really naive, and I like a good joke, so I responded with, must be the combat spurs, sir. And oh my God, I could not have said anything worse than that, because it turned out that neither the commander nor the command sergeant major nor anybody else except one NCO in that room had combat spurs. And that commander never forgave me for that. In fact, everybody else was authorized a meritorious service medal except me, and a second lieutenant at the end of that tour. Anyway, oh yeah, I have my spurs, so haha. Anyway, the thing about powerlessness is, if I can name the powerlessness of right now, that opens up worlds of possibility. Because immediately, when I recognize my stomach's tied up in knots, or I'm feeling really afraid or ashamed or not part of, less than, if I'm feeling grumpy or out of sorts, it means there's some powerlessness or other, or many, going on. And if I can then recognize, oh, this is about powerlessness, I'm immediately reminded that the AA big book says there is one who has all power, and my big book says that one is not Tim. Which I guess I really needed, because that's really important. May you find God now. And that reminds me that when I do the second step, I get the opportunity to do a fearless and searching moral inventory of my higher power. Have you ever done that? Have you ever done a searching and fearless moral inventory of your higher power? If you haven't, I highly recommend it, because I've learned that lower powers can masquerade as a higher power in my life. And I've learned in the third step, if I make a decision to turn my will and life over to the non-care of a lower power, I always come away feeling battered, bleeding, abandoned, and forsaken. So I've learned in my experience that when it comes to higher power, size matters. How big is your higher power? Is your higher power lacking any essential skill sets necessary to handle the challenge of you? Here's a way to figure out whether your higher power is big enough. Are you afraid to pray only for knowledge of God's will and the power to carry it out? Or do you really need to tell your higher power, you know what, higher power, I need this to happen in this particular situation, in this particular way? If I'm afraid that God's will isn't going to be my will, I don't have a big enough higher power. That means I don't trust that power. And I have learned that the bigger I demand my higher power get, the more fearlessly I get to live my life. Not recklessly, fearlessly. And the proof of that for me is that I went to Iraq without a freaking weapon. Only a humongous higher power could have brought that about. If I have a really humongous higher power, I get to put God's glasses on so that I get to find out how my higher power has always seen me. And I've learned that, you know, when Bill starts talking about the fourth step in the big book, he begins it with two surprising sentences. The first of which is, a business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. So right off the bat, Bill approaches the fourth step, at least on paper, as a business inventory. Now I ask you, does Bill describe a business inventory in the fourth step as found in the big book? No, not even in the 12 and 12. Because I'm not a business person, but it seems to me the point of a business inventory is to look at assets as well as liabilities. But Bill focuses only on liabilities. And I was talking about this once many years ago, and somebody at the back of the room said, that's not ego deflation at depth if you're looking at assets. So I said, thank you very much. And then I said, okay, let's do a little thought experiment here. Let's assume that God has created Tim Meyer to be an asshole. Okay? Now I'm doing my inventory. If in my inventory I find out Tim is an asshole, is that a character defect? Bueller? No, it's not a character defect. If God has created me to be an asshole, and I'm an asshole, that can't be a character defect. So I absolutely need to do a business inventory and find out that, in fact, God has created me to be gentle and thoughtful and compassionate and generous and kind. And if I'm an asshole, that's a really big problem, because look at all this potential. And you know, by doing a business inventory, oh, and here's a little aside, I get distracted by sparkly things, so just deal with it. I learned in Al-Anon that the Al-Anon Blueprint for Progress, which is their fourth step inventory workbook, is actually a business inventory, because it looks at assets as well as liabilities, and it always considers the assets first. Because the only way for me to know the exact nature of my wrongs is to see which assets have been ignored or stomped down or shat upon, in order to recognize just how serious this particular character defect is. And even more than that, the sixth step never made any sense to me. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. For 2 years, when I was living in Chicago, I would walk just about a half mile to get to a meeting every Saturday that was a two-hour fourth step meeting. Ugh, bone-crunchingly awful. And every week at that meeting, I would come away from there figuring it would be better for me to have amputations of limbs without any anesthesia than to do a fourth step. Because the fourth step was going to prove that I was lower than whale shit on the bottom of the ocean, which I already knew, but then everybody else was going to know that. So let's do the math here, Steve. If I'm entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character, and I am only defects of character, what will the result be? A vacuum. Nature abhors a vacuum. How could that make any sense? How could I become entirely ready for that? Now, if I have done a four-step inventory that is a business inventory, and I've uncovered all of these character assets that have never come to light before, it's a lot easier to become entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character, because I know there's all this good stuff waiting that's always been there. And you know, in the seventh step, when it talks about humbly ask God to remove these shortcomings, that finally fell into place when Father Tom, of course, explained that in his experience, what happens is we find these character defects, we ask God to move them out of our way so they're no longer stumbling blocks, and God does that. Except that I'm addicted to moving them back. So then I have to ask God to re-move them. But I'm addicted to moving them back. So I have to ask God to re-move them. And God does. And then I move them back. Now, one thing about becoming an old fart in the program, and you know, the way to do that is don't drink between meetings and don't die, right? Well, one advantage of becoming an old fart in the program is that I don't have the physical energy as often to move some of these things back as quickly. So it feels humiliating to have to keep asking God to remove this stuff. And the thing about my higher power is so big, my higher power doesn't know how to say no. And so if I ask, please move this, my higher power says, okay. And then, you know, in doing step 8, I think I skipped step 5, but I'll come back to that, I hope. How much time do I have left? I'm powerless over my mouth, in case you can't tell. When it comes to step 8, it's really important for me to remember what Al-Anon has written in their big book. Interestingly, under step 6, it reminds me that I am in a partnership with my higher power in my recovery. My higher power and I are partners in recovery. And so when I am in the process of making a list and looking at the harms I have done, I get to do that with my partner, who is the higher power, who cherishes me in the midst of the mess of my life, which is what doing the business inventory has shown me. And then I can actually get honest about the different levels and extents of harm that I have inflicted upon other people. Because, at least in my experience, harm is not one size fits all. And as I become willing to make amends, I also need to keep in mind something that was mentioned at the meeting yesterday, that we're only as sick as our secrets. And if I have an amend that needs making, but I'm telling myself I'm going to carry this to my grave, there is no way I'm ever going to bring this up, well, I will carry it to my grave, probably earlier than later. And so when I'm making an amends, I get the opportunity to set things right. I was really adept at saying, I'm sorry, I didn't mean it, but the words tripped off my lips easily. The real test of my mettle is, can I set things right? And if I remember that I'm in this partnership with my higher power, who is so humongous, the higher power is not lacking any essential skill sets necessary to handle the challenge of Tim. This higher power who cherishes me in the midst of the mess, not only the mess that I've made, but the mess that I've become, then it's easy to recognize that I get to trust that higher power. And in that trust, I can do things that I would never have before imagined myself capable of doing, like telling the truth. When I was a little person in a goofy family, I figured, why tell the truth when a lie would suffice? And besides, lies can be so much more creative. Thank you. I'm powerless over my mouth, but I have a couple of minutes left. So in the 10th step, I get to recognize that the program assumes the truth about me, which is, I'm going to mess up. Because the 10th step says, when we're wrong, promptly admitted it, not if we're wrong, promptly admitted it. And that means then I get to be reminded that I have this higher power who cherishes me. Has any of you ever heard somebody say to you, I love you in spite of, and then fill in the blank? Well, let's do the math about that statement. If I'm loving you in spite of something, it means I'm enduring you. I'm putting up with you. But if I love you in the midst of what's going on, that's real love. And I've found through this program a higher power who cherishes me in the midst of the mess I have become and in the midst of the messes I make. And in the 10th step, I get to be reminded of that. So my 10th step always begins with gratitude. For me, gratitude is the measure of my spiritual condition. My 10th step always begins with gratitude. And as I'm recognizing the ways in which I have messed up yet again, I get to say, thank you, God, that I haven't had to drink over this. Please help me to not drink over this. And then my 10th step ends with gratitude. And you know what? The 10th step then actually is part of my 11th step. Because if I begin and move through gratitude and end with gratitude, in the 10th step, that's prayer. I'm very grateful that I've learned the value of mindful breathing as a component of my meditation, because that helps to reduce my stress levels immensely. Ironically, I did a doctoral degree in brain biology in a stress lab at Stanford. One final story. I got in a lot of trouble again. On that deployment to Kosovo, somebody was talking about me with a cadre and alluded to my education. I have a lot of education. And I'm still a drunk, so there's that. Anyway, one day I had to give the chaplain brief to the commander, who was a one-star general, and this was all being overseen by a three-star retired general. And so after my thing, the three-star pipes up, and he said something somewhat disparaging about me and education. And I thought to myself, self, he will never do this to me again. So I paused, and I said, well, sir, with all due respect, I love that phrase, I do have more degrees than a rectal thermometer. And there was an audible intake of air by about 80 people in that room all at the same time. He was not very pleased with me. But in any event, in step 12, we get to carry this message. And isn't it great that it's not a two-step program? The first step being, our lives are really effed up. And the second step being step 12, come join us. In step 12, we get the chance to carry the message of hope to folks who need help that only we can provide. So I'm very grateful to have been here. If you haven't heard anything worth hearing, that just means you were paying attention. However, there is somebody who will be speaking in a little less than an hour, and that will definitely be worth your time. So thank you for being here this morning, and blessings upon all of us.